The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas B. Gibbs, a broadcast that examines our ever-changing world through the lens of the United States Constitution. Douglas B. Gibbs is on the air.
Welcome. I am Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution. Welcome to the program here on Mr. Constitution Hour, KPRZ. And where we left off last week was we finished Article 1, Section 8. We wrapped up with the Necessary and Proper Clause. The folks who oppose the United States Constitution call it the Elastic Clause because they can stretch it in any direction they want to. So we're going to pick up in Article 1, Section 9. And for those of you who are following along, we are working our way through the Constitution, Article 1, Section 9. If you've missed past episodes, you can go to our podcast page. You can go to douglasvgibbs.com/radio, find it there. Or you can go to iHeartRadio and just look for Mr. Constitution Hour with Douglas V. Gibbs, and you can catch up on past episodes. Okay, so Article 1, Section 9, it says the migration and importation of such persons as any of the states now existing shall think proper to admit should not be prohibited by Congress prior to the year 1808. You know, it's funny because I was talking to someone from one of my Constitution classes. I have six of them in Southern California, this one in Beaumont. And the woman has a son who is not necessarily in full agreement with her. And the person responded to something she had said with this: interesting how they seem to have no issue keeping slavery or not allowing women the right to vote, though, isn't it? Who was actually being treated equal in that Constitution they built? The reference being in the Declaration of Independence, it says that all men are created equal. Well, first of all, it says created equal. It doesn't say treated equal. They understood that people weren't being treated equally necessarily, first of all. Second of all, when it comes to being treated equally, there's a fine line there. We want everybody to be treated equally under the law, but that's where equality really stops. God made us individualistic, individuals that are different from each other. We have different skills, and thank goodness we are different from each other and that we're individuals and we don't share the same skills, so forth, or I'd be out of business because everybody would know the Constitution. But the question is interesting. It kind of ties into what we're talking about here. First of all, there were people who had attended the entire Constitutional Convention who walked out because, you know, didn't sign it because, you know, they didn't abolish slavery. Slavery was a big issue. And, when it came to those states at the time, they wanted to get rid of slavery, but the problem was, in the further south you went, the more important slavery became economically. And they also wanted the states to make that decision for themselves. They didn't want the central system dictating to the states what they could or could not do regarding the issue. However, in preparation for slavery, the issue, they decided, since this Constitution would be about a federal government that handles external issues, not within the states, they would at least address the external part of slavery. So the Article 1, Section 9 addresses that, and what it says is that the importation of slaves, in other words, the Atlantic slave trade, would be outlawed. Now, as a compromise, they gave the states a number of years to prepare for it. This is 1787. They give them about 20 years. But January 1st, 1808, or actually, yeah, 20 years. And so January 1st, 1808, Congress would have the authority, according to this, to outlaw the Atlantic slave trade. Compromise, they gave them 20 years. They didn't just do it immediately. Once again, you got to work with what you got. And that's what it says. The migration or importation of such persons, the such persons being those who are treated as property, because the word importation is there, they're imported, that the states, any of the states now existing, shall think proper to admit, shall be prohibited by Congress, or it shall not be prior to the year 1808. So what happened is in March of 1807, the legislation was drawn up. Jefferson signed it, and it was then put into place and activated or effective January 1st, 1808. Atlantic slave trade was outlawed. 13,000 slaves from January 1st, 1808 until the war between the states still made it to the Atlantic shore there on the in the United States, but those were brought in illegally. They were smuggled in. It was not something that the United States said was okay. So there you go. Now, there's an interesting set of terms here. It says the migration or importation of such persons. All right, so it's also saying that the these persons who are going to be enslaved cannot be migrated over the border or migrated into the country in addition to the Atlantic slave trade. However, also the word migration, that gives Congress the authority to really make any law regarding migration. And that would be immigration. Now, we are told Article 1, Section 8, where it gives Congress the authority to establish a uniform rule of naturalization is what gives the federal government authority over immigration law. But it's actually Article 1, Section 9, the migration. And so that, from there on out, January 1st, 1808, the job of immigration transferred from the states to the federal government. So understand that prior to January 1st, 1808, the states had all authorities regarding immigration. Then they transferred the allowance to prohibit migration into the United States to Congress. All other immigration authorities remain with the states. So states can still remove immigrants that are illegal from their states. They still have that authority. It's a concurrent issue. Legislature can make the law to prohibit certain persons from coming in, and the executive branch can act upon that law, hence the Border Patrol, ICE, and all that. But all the other immigration issues are reserved to the states. Then it says, but a tax or duty may be imposed on such importation, not exceeding $10 for each person. What they began to do once this Constitution was ratified is tax. See, before there was no tax on the importation of these persons from Africa for the purpose of slavery. But tax began to become imposed after the Constitution was ratified in 1788. People say, well, gosh, they were trying to make money off of slavery. No. There's an old known concept. The more you tax something, the less of that activity you get. So you start taxing cigarettes, less people are going to smoke. You start taxing driving, you're probably going to get less people driving. You start taxing, you know, anything directly, it tends to reduce the usage of the item because the price goes up, less people can afford it, or less people are willing to pay the tax. So the more you tax something, it tends to lead to less activity. So the idea here is there's going to be a penalty for the importation of slaves. You're going to pay a tax, and that not is not only something that the federal government could put in its coffer, but that's going to reduce the activity, or at least that's the idea. So that's Article 1, Section 9. Let's continue on Article 1, Section 9, Clause 2. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended. Habeas corpus in Latin means present the body. In other words, the idea of presenting the body will not be suspended. What do they mean by that? It's a legal term. So if someone is arrested, the courts require the arresting agency to present the body, you know, for due process to the court so they can stand trial. To hold a person without presenting the body to the legal system is unlawful, it's unconstitutional, because everybody deserves their day in court. So the privilege of the writ of habeas corpus shall not be suspended unless, there's a caveat here, when in cases of rebellion or invasion, the public safety may require it. That may be the excuse that our federal government's using, holding our January 6 people. If you don't follow the news, there have been over 700 people that were arrested for being on the grounds of the Capitol on January 6, 2020. They were accused of, according to certain members of our government, of insurrection or rebellion, and many of them were arrested, And the trials have been slow. They have not gone through the proper due process. Due process includes a speedy trial, a public trial, and so on and so forth. They haven't been getting that. So a lot of people believe that they're being held unconstitutionally. I agree with that. I believe that those people were not rebelling. I do not believe it was an insurrection. I believe it was a, first of all, it was something staged. It was a it was a false flag event in which the enemies of the Constitution put themselves in a position to mimic that it was a Trump supporter uprising. I believe that there were certain characters that had planned for it, were involved in it, and instigated it. Once the Trump supporters arrived on the scene after his speech, which was after the initial issue began to percolate, those people were peaceful. They did not go into places they weren't supposed to, and so on and so forth. So, you know, I think it was a false flag. But nonetheless, in the Constitution, if they were rebelling, and the persons that now hold the primary seats of control in government say they were, then this part of the Constitution would say, okay, well, in cases of rebellion and invasion, the public safety is requiring that these dangerous people be held. The privilege of the writ of habeas corpus may be suspended. Once again, I don't believe this was a rebellion. I believe they're being falsely imprisoned. But nonetheless, that's the excuse they're using from a constitutional standpoint. All right, let's continue. It says, no bill of attainder or ex post facto law shall be passed. Once again, we're in Article 1, Section 9 of the United States Constitution. I am Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution, here on K-Praise. No bill of attainder. What is a bill of attainder? Okay, the word bill is our first clue. The word bill means it's something legislative, because it is the legislature that passed bills. So we have a legislative instrument, a bill of attainder. What does attainder mean? It means to hold or to charge. And so no bill of attainder, in other words, no piece of a legislation charging someone and convicting them is allowed. So in other words, the legislative branch cannot act in a judicial manner. The judicial branch holds on to all judicial authorities. So you can't have a bill, a legislative instrument, that acts judicially, in other words, of attainder, of attaining somebody, of arresting them and convicting them. And then it says, or ex post facto law shall be passed. Ex post facto is Latin for after the fact, a retroactive law. So let's say, hypothetically, they outlaw magazines for your guns that hold more than 10 bullets. If you bought one legally, they can't say, well, that's now illegal. That's ex post facto. It was legal when you bought it, therefore it's still legal in your possession. They may have the authority, and when I say they, we know who I'm talking about, have the authority to make law that maybe outlaw something, not necessarily wanting to get into the gun issue per se. Yeah, when we get Second Amendment, we'll get deeper into that. But they can't say, well, since it's illegal now, it was illegal then, so you have to turn in all of your illegal stuff because whatever you bought legally is now illegal. No, that's ex post facto law. You can't do that. I know California, ex post facto law is also in Article 1, Section 10. So Article 1, Section 9, federal government cannot pass ex post facto law. Article 1, Section 10, the state governments cannot pass ex post facto law. And I know California did one, oh, it was years ago. I think it was Prop 32, I think. But anyway, what it did is it was a tax that was retroactive to the prior January. No, you can't do that. Unconstitutional. No retroactive law. So you can't say something's suddenly illegal and that everybody who bought it legal has turned in because whatever they had that was legal is suddenly illegal. No, their purchase is grandfathered in, and you can't make taxes retroactive back to some date back in the past. No ex post facto law at the federal level or at the state level. This one here, Article 1, Section 9, is addressing federal more specifically. Then it says, no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid. No capitation. Capitation is an interesting word. It means head tax. Best way to remember it is, you know, if you go through a decapitation, you lose your head, right? So then a capitation must mean you keep your head, but you're losing something else. So no capitation or other direct tax. In other words, the federal government originally, we'll get into what income tax with the IRS and all that is about when we get to the 16th Amendment. But originally, there was not supposed to be any taxes by the federal government directly on the people. No head tax, no capitation or other direct tax shall be laid. Then it says, unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. The direct tax that it's referring to, where there's a, in proportion to the census, was that the income tax was a direct tax on the states. It was an indirect tax on the people, it was a direct tax on the states. The states paid it. But when the states paid that income tax, they were in line with what it was when it came to the census. In other words, the percentage of their population determined how much they would pay in the sense of the percentage of that income tax to the federal government to pay the federal budget. So today, for example, the California population is 11.91% of the overall population. Let's just say 12% to keep it easy. So if the old way of doing it was in place, California would pay 12% of the total budget. Now, that said, if the state is paying the budget, not a person, there's no direct tax on the people, the direct tax goes to the states, then the state has the ability, because it's a much larger entity, it doesn't depend on the same things that we depend on, it doesn't, it's not afraid of the federal government, it's the federal government, the states are the federal government's parents. So rather than just pay the tax because you fear, you know, a lien being put on your house or something like that, in today's society, the direct tax on the states, so the states were able to look at the budget. And they looked at it and they said, hey, this is unconstitutional. We're not paying for it. Try again. And the budget would be sent back. The federal government then would have to reconsider their budget. So the states controlled what the federal government was spending. They had a say in it. They had oversight. Remember, the delegates in the Constitutional Convention represented the states. The states created the federal government with the Constitution, and therefore the states are the parents over the federal government. So when it came to the states being the parents, that means that they wanted to do anything they could to have oversight over this creature they created, the federal government. You know, just like a parent want to have oversight over their child's life, or at least until their child is to the point where they can take care of themselves. In the case of the federal government, it's never going to be able to take care of itself because it has a potential for tyranny. So the states set up oversight, and one of the oversights was the budget. They could see the budget, they could read the budget, and they would only approve constitutional spending. Prior to 1913, when the Federal Reserve was put into place, the 16th Amendment allowed for a direct tax on the people, which even that I think is not necessarily legitimate, but we'll get to that when we get to the 16th Amendment. You have, again, a situation where the states can monitor, take care of, make sure that the federal government's spending in the way they wants to. All right, and that they want it to. So no capitation or other tax, direct tax, shall be laid unless in proportion to the census or enumeration herein before directed to be taken. Before directed to be taken, or earlier in the Constitution, census was created. The first one was going to happen 3 years after the writing of the Constitution. After that, it would be every 10 years. They set it up so that it would fall on the years that end with zero. All right, then it says, no tax or duty shall be laid on articles exported from any state. In other words, and what it means is not that there can't be any export tax per se from the United States, but that the states cannot have an export tax, and that there would be no tax laid on something leaving a state. For example, when it comes to commerce between the states are now a country. They are not separate sovereign entities in the same way they were before. They are in the sense that they are sovereign enough that they're going to take care of their own internal business, their own internal issues. But ultimately, they are part of a country, and so as a part of a country, they are not going to now hit each other with an import or export tax between the states, and the federal government can't lay that tax either. Okay, and then it says, no preference shall be given by any regulation of commerce or revenue to the ports of one state over those of another. So the Baltimore port, New York, you know, Boston Harbor, whatever, they all have, LA port, they all have to be treated equally under the federal law. They can't give preference. And this was to protect against the large states who would have more representation in the House of Representatives trying to pass bills that would give their states preference because they have a larger voice in the legislature. And then it says that nor shall vessels bound to or from one state be obliged to enter, clear, and pay duties in another. Once again, these states are no longer separate entities in the sense of their own little countries. They are still sovereign in the sense that they're going to take care of their own business for the most part. But now that we're united into a country, it's a union, United States of America. The states are now have to treat each other as if they are a part of the country. So they're not going to be charging each other duties, which is just another way of saying taxes, in order for the boat to, you know, like pull into a harbor. Let's say, well, gosh, you know, you're a boat from New Jersey. This is New York Harbor. We're going to charge you because you're from a different country. No. New Jersey and New York, whether they want to admit it or not, are part of the same country now. And so those duties, those deals that these harbors and these ports had when it comes to boats from other countries does not apply to those from other states because we're all part of the same country. No money shall be drawn from the treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. Okay, appropriations means how they're going to deal the money out, made by law. The House of Representatives has the power of the purse strings. They're the ones that must propose any budget that has anything to do with revenue. And money being drawn from the Treasury is normally attached to the revenue, so if there's going to be any money pulled from the Treasury, what it's saying is a bill has to be passed that starts with the House of Representatives, and then it must be approved by both houses of Congress, and then signed by the President. In other words, you can't be pulling money out without going through the full process. They didn't want, you know, entities in the government just saying, oh, we're going to spend this money on this. Now, what they've done to get around that is they appropriate money for basically a slush fund. So it sits in a account that's designed, let's say, for military spending. And so if it has anything to do with military, even if it's just remotely involved with military, it can be used for that. That way, every time they need money for every little thing, they don't necessarily have to get approval from Congress and go through the House and then the Senate and, you know, and all that jazz. So, you know, hey, we need to buy some more nuts and bolts for our, you know, F-35s that, you know, President Biden says he's willing to use against the people. Where do we get the money for these nuts and bolts? Oh, we're going to have to talk to Congress. They're going to have to pass a bill. No. That money has already been apportioned or appropriated for that purpose, for military purpose or whatnot. So no money shall be drawn from the Treasury, but in consequence of appropriations made by law and a regular statement of and account of the receipts and expenditures of all public money shall be published from time to time. That's called transparency. And yes, they were expected to show how they spent their money. Now, that said, I love the fact, well, I don't love it, but it cracks me up that we've got, you know, government entities that they don't know how to shop. You know, you remember those nuts and bolts I was talking about for the F-35? You know, they might pay hundreds of dollars or thousands of dollars for each bolt because they have an agreement with such and such a contractor. The contractor knows that they're going to buy it no matter what, and they don't go shopping for the lowest price because they're just the government and they just do what they're told, and they buy from whoever they're told to buy from. I remember when I worked for a city at one point, and I remember that I was looking at the budget, and they were buying, items for the administrative items for, like, you know, staples, you know, that kind of stuff. And they were using the same company, the same store they'd used since before I was born. I told him, I said, well, gosh, you know, you've got this mart and that mart that you could save money if you shopped there. And they said, well, that's no, because then that's, you know, not the way we've always done it. We're only going to buy from this place, but you're paying more money. Yeah, but that's who we buy from. They're not willing to do the things to save money because it's not their money. If it was their money, they'd be out there shopping. They would, you know, be checking out the Pick and Scrounge or such and such mart or Little Mart and Big Mart and so on and so forth, looking for the best price. The government doesn't look for the best price. All right, last clause in Article 1, Section 9. Last clause in Article 1, Section 9, then we'll take a break. No title of nobility shall be granted by the United States, and no person holding any office of profit or trust under them shall, without the consent of the Congress, accept of any present emolument, office, or title of any kind, whatever, from any king, prince, or foreign state. So, all men are created equal, which means there's no privileged class. There's no nobility. And so no title of nobility shall be granted by the United States. There will be no privileged class. All men are created equal. And if you hold office, you also can't get nobility or some type of title or something like that, or even money, emolument, from foreign governments, because you will lose your ability to hold your office. Now, that said, that exact same, well, almost the same language was also in an amendment. There was an amendment that was added to the Constitution. It was ratified in 1811. It was the original 13th Amendment. This original 13th Amendment, though, ultimately vanished. Now, this original 13th Amendment, which vanished right before the war, right during the war between the states, what it did is it disallowed also any holding titles or receiving money from foreign governments, all that, for citizens. And the key part of that was that they didn't want lawyers to be a part of the international bar. They didn't want international banking situations. And there were books that were published during the early 1800s. And during the 1800s that show this 13th Amendment, and a friend of mine has a copy of one of those books. It's called Military Laws of the United States, in which the prefixed, which is prefixed the Constitution of the United States, compiled and published under authority of the War Department by Truman Cross. So that's the title page. And here's what the 13th Amendment reads in that book. So this is the actual language of the 13th Amendment that vanished. If any citizen of the United States shall accept, claim, receive, or retain any title of nobility or honor, or shall, without the consent of Congress, accept and retain any present pension, office, or emolument of any kind, whatever, from any emperor, king, prince, or foreign power, such person shall cease to be a citizen of the United States and shall be incapable of holding any office of trust or profit under them or either of them, the them being the states. So what it's basically saying is we're not going to allow divided allegiance. We're not going to allow you to be tied into international systems. You are American. You act American. You're part of America, and that's it. There came the legal system, the bar system, which means British Accreditation Registry. There was an international bar that lawyers were part of, and this outlawed that. Our lawyers, our bankers, they could not be dealing with international organizations. They had to deal with what was American. This was an attempt to stamp out divided loyalty and foreign influence. We had the Tories going on at the time. The Tories were loyalists to the crown. They believed that we should still be under the British Empire, and that was one of the things they were trying to guard against. And we can get more into that when we get to Article 2, the Natural Born Citizen Clause. But basically, the missing 13th Amendment disallowed participation in anything that was, well, foreign, that would give you a foreign title, give you foreign money, and so on and so forth. So the international bar was outlawed, international banking was outlawed, and the charter for the First Bank of the United States had just expired and was not renewed. This goes back to Alexander Hamilton back in 1791, in which he established a 20-year charter for the Bank of the United States. Charter was up in 20 years, 1811, and it was not renewed. And so that separated us from the British banking system, and the bankers of Europe and the legal system in Europe was pretty ticked off because we had separated ourselves from the banking system. We had separated ourselves from the international bar. And a gentleman by the name of Nelson Rockefeller, it is said, whether or not he actually said this has been argued for a very long time by people on both sides, but this is what he allegedly said. Nelson Rockefeller allegedly said that if the United States doesn't fix this and get back to, you know, being a part of the international community, that they will be in a war. 6 months after he said that, we are told the War of 1812 started. So that does shed light on what may have been the beginning of the War of 1812. It may not necessarily be just what historians say, where, you know, the British were ignoring our sovereignty and abusing the sovereignty of the United States, not recognizing our sovereignty as a country. by not removing forts in the western edge of our country, by attacking our ships and taking our sailors because they believe them to still be members of the British Empire, because once you're a subject of the British Empire, you are for life, and so on and so forth. And that's a lot of what people believe started the War of 1812. I am suggesting that the expiration of the Charter of the Bank of the United States and the establishment of the original 13th Amendment, which outlawed foreign titles of foreign enumeration, that outlawed the receiving of foreign emoluments by persons that were Americans, and you would lose your citizenship. I mean, that's a pretty harsh penalty. Lose your citizenship if you betrayed that. Anyway, so that's that. Article 1, Section 9, in its completion. Let's take a break, and then we'll start with Article 1, Section 10. Don't go anywhere.
We are the socialists. You will be assimilated. Your individual liberties, personal freedoms, and mental individuality will be added to our own. Resistance is futile.
Creator by Douglas V. Gibbs is on sale now. His eighth book, A True Action Plan for Christians When It Comes to Restoring the Republic. The keystone of American liberty is the Creator. Without a godly foundation, like an arch without its keystone, our whole system comes crumbling down. Thanks to age-old ideologies and an ancient lust for power and wealth, once again, our world is upside down. Evil has become good, and good has become evil. The churches have been infiltrated, and the rule of law has been replaced by the rule of man. To restore our liberty and the virtuous nature of our country, we must understand what is happening and what to do. Creator is a book that illuminates the realities that swirl around the foundation of American liberty and addresses seven critical issues directly related to our system of liberty that we must understand, address, and fight. For if we are to reestablish our American way of life on a foundation, a cornerstone based on the Founding Fathers' beliefs in our Creator, and as Thomas Jefferson wrote in the Declaration of Independence, the laws of nature and of nature's God, whenever any form of government becomes destructive of these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it. It is their right, it is their duty to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. That was in the Declaration of Independence, and now our time has come upon us. Now it is our turn. How do we address what is going on? What are the true causes of the rise of tyranny in America? What steps must we take as a people to keep the Republic? It all begins with our Creator. On sale now by Douglas V. Gibbs. Learn more at Amazon.com or DouglasVGibbs.com/store.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled. You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
Tired of the lies? Come here for the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Our records indicate you've been lied to. Welcome to the truth. Douglas V. Gibbs.
All I'm offering is the truth. Nothing more.
USA, do you know about the government? Can you tell me about the Constitution? Hey, learn about the USA.
The Constitution is the instruction booklet for taking back the country. Douglas V. Gibbs.
1787, I'm told our founding fathers did agree to write a list of principles for keeping people.
Thank you.
welcome back to the Mr. Constitution Hour here on K-Praise, San Diego's Christian station, AM and FM for North County and San Diego. Okay, so now we are in Article 1, Section 10. Once again, my name is Douglas V. Gibbs, Mr. Constitution. This is the Mr. Constitution Hour on KPRZ, K-Praise, 1210 AM, 106.1 FM in San Diego County. You can listen online at kprz.com. And, of course, catch the podcast later if you miss the live episode. You go to douglasvgibbs.com/radio, douglasvgibbs.com/radio, and that information will come up. And let's go through Article 1, Section 10. No state shall enter into any treaty, alliance, or confederation. This is the argument Abraham Lincoln used when it came to using military operations against the Confederate States, the United States. However, the Confederate States were no longer under the Constitution. They had seceded. They had left the contract. So he was actually invading a foreign country. It was not, they were not in violation of this one. No state shall enter any treaty, alliance, or confederation. Grant letters of marque and reprisal. No state shall grant marks letters of marque and reprisal. That was a federal issue. That is something the federal government does because the federal government has the common defense, the military. And marks of letters of marque and reprisal were like, for example, you have a merchant vessel and the Americans say, hey, you know, we're going to give you this letter of marque. You now also represent the U.S. Navy. Federal government can do that. States cannot. No state shall coin money, emit bills of credit, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in the payment of debts. So they can't coin their own money. That's something that Congress was established to do in Article 1, Section 8. They didn't want conflicting currencies. One currency for the Union, one currency for the country, and that would be through what the Congress is coining. And then it says emit bills of credit. A bill of credit is an instrument of debt. So if a state cannot emit a bill of credit, that means they cannot emit a bill of an instrument of debt. So they can't have bonds, they can't have promissory notes, and so on and so forth. How many states have like school bonds and stuff like that? They're violating the Constitution. They're not supposed to borrow money. They're supposed to be able to pay their own way. What they have, they're not supposed to go into debt. Going into debt at the state level is unconstitutional. I think 48 states at this moment are in debt. All right, so then it goes on. The last one, and I'll reread it, make anything but gold and silver coin a tender in payment of debts. So in other words, you're only going to accept the gold and silver coin being printed or created by Congress. What that does is that it doubles down on what we saw in Article 1, Section 8 about Congress coining money. That makes paper money unconstitutional. Coin, gold coin, silver coin, that's supposed to pay debt, not paper money. Paper money is a promissory note. It is a bill of credit. Pass any bill of attainder, ex post facto law, or law impairing the obligation of contracts. Those first two we saw in Article 1, Section 9. Federal government can't do it. The states can't do it. Bill of attainder, ex post facto law. You cannot use legislative instruments to act judicially. And you cannot make laws ex post facto, after the fact, retroactive. We talked about that earlier with that retroactive tax California had that went back to the prior January. Can't do it. Can't say, hey, we're going to outlaw your gun magazine, so that means everybody that has one, turn it in. No. If I bought it legally, it's grandfathered in. You cannot pass ex post facto law under the Constitution. I am waiting for lawyers to start using that for when it comes to some of these gun control laws that these states are putting out there. Okay, and so then it said, or law impairing the obligation of contracts. That's any contract. A law cannot be passed by a state that would impair the obligation of a contract. Contracts between you and I or between two people, two individuals. State can't impair that contract with a law. So I have to ask, does that, when it says law impairing obligation contracts, would that include actions also by the state, such as mandates, mandates that might impair employment contracts, service contracts, things like that because of, I don't know, something like a lockdown? It definitely needs to be questioned. or grant any title of nobility. So, like the federal government, who can't grant title of nobility, neither can the states. There is not to be any position of preference in the sense of nobility in the United States. Do we have positions of preference? We sure feel like it, don't we, with some of these political knuckleheads. But ultimately, the states and the federal government are not supposed to grant any title of nobility. No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any impost or duties on imports or exports. Congress must approve if there's going to be any import or export tax, except what may be absolutely necessary for executing its inspection laws. California is a great example of this. California doesn't want any fruit coming into the country, into its state. So, yeah, I mean, if you've ever driven into California, there's a stop, there's a hut or something where you have to stop and talk to a state officer or and declare whether or not you have fruit. You know, it's funny. One time I was crossing the border and I have a residency that's actually outside of California, although I split my time between that residency and California. And I'm coming back with a bunch of ammo, and I thought, because I know the ammo laws here are strict, but as a, out-of-state person, it's legal for me to come into the state with ammunition. And I thought that would be their concern. I was practically low-riding. I had so much. And, I get to the window. She could care less about whether or not I had ammo. But do you have any fruit? I just thought it was kind of comical, to be honest with you. So, now, what that means is that if there's an inspection process, like asking for fruit and checking out cars and all that by California, they can do that, but they're not supposed to charge more than whatever it costs for executing its inspection laws. And the net produce of all duties and imposts, it says, laid by any state on imports or exports shall be for the use of Treasury of the United States. So, in other words, if they charge something, if there's money made and there's a profit, anything that goes beyond what it cost them to take care of their inspection laws, whether it's at the ports or at the state line, whether it's a ship coming in or it's a car like mine, if they make a profit, anything extra goes to the Treasury of the United States. The state's not supposed to make a profit on imports. And all such laws shall be subject to the revision and control of the Congress. So they want states playing these games, and so Congress has the authority to alter such regulations as they see necessary. Final clause in Article 1, Section 10. No state shall, without the consent of Congress, lay any duty on tonnage. All right, so now we have to ask ourselves, what is tonnage and what is the duty? So the word tonnage means cargo capacity. How much tons that a ship can carry and so forth, and that states can no longer lay a tax on that. And there were states that did that under the Articles of Confederation, but this is now a federal duty. Remember, the states cannot lay import or export taxes. So any duty tax on tonnage, cargo capacity, could not be done by the states. It had to be done by the federal government. Then it says, keep troops or ships of war in time of peace. So we have a common defense. So the states are not really supposed to have its own army unless it's something that's approved by Congress, which is what the state militias are. So it says, keep troops or ships of war in time of peace, enter into any agreement or compact with another state or with a foreign power, or engage in war unless actually invaded or in such imminent danger as will not admit of delay. So they can have their militias, but they can't engage in war, they can't act upon something in a military style unless they are being invaded or they believe they're in imminent danger as will not admit of delay. So now then we have to ask a question. Is illegal immigration an invasion? And so if it is, then do the states have the authority to send their state militias, National Guard, or their state militia or whatever group that's under the state control to the border to guard against that invasion? Absolutely. Absolutely. Each state has that authority. Whether or not they'll act upon that authority, that's a whole different ballgame. But they do have that authority. So that's Article 1, Section 10. I want to do a real quick review. I don't want to start Article 2 just yet. We'll wait until next week. So when it comes to the states, remember that these states, they are the parents over the federal government. They're the ones that created the system. They're the ones that created the federal government. They're the ones that wrote the Constitution with their delegates at the Constitutional Convention. So as the parents over this federal system, they wanted to make sure that they had oversight over it. They were able to act in a manner to make sure that it did not misbehave, it did not act inappropriately, it did not act in a manner that was beyond its authorities granted. Remember, the Constitution is about authorities granted when it comes to the federal government. If it's not expressly enumerated as an authority, the federal government doesn't have the authority. That's the way the Constitution is. But when it comes to the states, they hold what's called original authority. They have original authority over all of the issues, all of the powers. Originally, they had all of the authorities over everything, and they decided to give some of those authorities away to this federal government so it could handle external issues or things that would promote, protect, or preserve the union. The way I like to explain this, for those of you who want to learn a little bit more, Federalist 45 by James Madison. Federalist 45 by James Madison, which is a key Federalist paper, and when James Madison wrote it, he wanted to make sure everybody understood when he wrote this what the actual powers of the two entities, the federal government and the states, actually were. So he wrote this: "The powers delegated by the proposed Constitution to the federal government are few and defined, not very many, and they're defined, they're expressly enumerated. Those which are to remain in the state governments are numerous and indefinite." The states, in other words, have an unbelievably long list of authorities. "The former, the federal authorities, will be exercised principally on external objects, as war, peace, negotiation, and foreign commerce, with which the last power of taxation will, for the most part, be connected. The powers reserved to the several states will extend to all the objects which in the ordinary course of affairs concern the lives, liberties, and properties of the people." So our regular lives, what normally happens to our lives, and so on and so forth, that's a state issue. "And the internal order, improvement, and prosperity of the state. The operations of the federal government will be most extensive and important in times of war and danger, those of the state governments in times of peace and security." Federalist 45, James Madison. So the federal government has a few powers, that authorities that's been given. They're not supposed to take more powers. They have, but that's we'll get more into that another time. And then the states have everything else. So if the federal government doesn't have an authority, and like Article 1, Section 10, it's not prohibited to the state, it's a state authority, period. So how do you know if the federal government can do something? Is it in the Constitution? If it is, as an authority, they can. If it's not, they can't. How do you know if a state can do something? If it is not the Constitution prohibiting them from doing it, or it's not given as a federal authority, the state has the authority, regardless of what it is. It not being the Constitution is a key point, because their authorities are numerous and indefinite. So there you go. So Article 1, Section 9, Article 1, Section 10. Next week we'll get into Article 2. And I'm going to do a little bit of an introduction about Christianity and the president and leader of a country. What does that mean from a godly perspective? And then, of course, we'll dip into the Constitution to give you the constitutional perspective and then see how the two compare with each other and support each other. So that is today's program. Thank you for listening. My name is Douglas V. Gibbs, DouglasVGibbs.com. All of my books are available. There's also other products that I'm constantly trying to add. Go to DouglasVGibbs.com/store. DouglasVGibbs.com/store for my products. If you would like to learn more about my radio programs, DouglasVGibbs.com/radio. DouglasVGibbs.com/radio. If you would like to be on my email list, go to DouglasVGibbs.com. Right there on the main page, on the right-hand side, there's a red arrow blinking, pointing toward it. There's an image that says, "Join our email list." Click that image. The information page for you to fill out comes up. Fill it out. You're on the email list. The email list, if you're on it, you will receive emails about that remind you of all of my classes. Included in that are the handouts and videos, things I write, so on and so forth. Now, if you don't want to get the class reminders, send me an email at constitutionspeaker@yahoo.com, constitutionspeaker@yahoo.com. After you add yourself to the email list, let me know, and then I will move you into a folder where you will get articles and videos, things like that only. You won't get all the reminders for the classes. Most people like the reminders for the classes. Okay, but anyway, So that's it. United we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America and God bless you. We'll see you next week here on Cray Praise. Thank you for listening to the Mr. Constitution Hour. Oh, and one more thing before we go. If you enjoy this program, you want to share it, be sure to do so. Send out emails, talk to your friends about it. Mr. Constitution Hour on Cray Praise. They should be able to find it that way. You can also, of course, forward them links to the programs and things like that. Because we don't get this information out there if we're not all working together to share the information. So it's important that you share this program with your friends. Share this program with people that you know. Let other people know that there is somebody out there that's going through the Constitution and using a Christian angle when he talks about the Constitution. So Mr. Constitution Hour on Saturday nights at 9 p.m. Pacific. KPRZ.com. KPraise. Share the show, share the website, and now I think we're done. So united we stand, combined we kick butt. God bless America and God bless you. Appreciate the fact that you spend the time listening to the program. Appreciate the fact that you spend the time coming here to learn the Constitution. I hope you are learning something. And don't forget, you can also email me at constitutionspeaker@yahoo.com, constitutionspeaker@yahoo.com. I'd love to hear from you. And if you got questions, I'll address them on the air. And don't forget also on KMET 1490 AM on Saturdays from 1 to 3 Pacific, KMET1490AM.com. I also have a radio program there called Constitution Radio with co-hosts Dennis Jackson and Alan Myers. That show is the issues of the day through the lens of the Constitution. This program here on KPraise is the Constitution through the lens of Christianity. So you have two programs to choose from. Listen to one or the either or the other or both. And like I said, make sure you share it with your friends and your family and all that. We need to get the word out. We need to stop what's going on in this country. We need to, well, save America. And that my goal is to spread constitutional literacy and to promote patriotic advocacy. And we do that through the programs. My nonprofit at constitutionassociation.com. Various videos I do, youtube.com/DouglasVGibbs. You can buy my books at my store, douglasvgibbs.com/store. Once again, if you enjoy the program, you appreciate the fact I'm going through the Constitution, buy the products, share the show, make sure that everybody you know is listening. I would like to be able to take this, hey, Monday through Friday someday. So let's grow it and let's share this program with everybody. All right, so we'll see you next week. Thank you for listening, and God bless. We are now out of here.
Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.